Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded, though, by people who can support us, your family, friends, and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Over the previous weeks, we've heard two stories of courage and bravery, one from Beck and one from Neil, whose childhoods were stripped from them by predators. Child abuse is a global issue affecting millions. In fact, the World Health Organization last year reported 1 in 5 women and 1 in 7 men have been sexually abused as a child, not to mention the 6 in 10 children under 5 years of age who suffer physical and or psychological violence at the hands of their parents or caregivers. Just to put it into perspective, that's 400 million children. Statistically, the consequences of child maltreatment can mean lifelong trauma at the very least, and for some, a life of violence. Christy McVee is a child abuse prevention educator and child safety expert who's worked with offenders and victims. Firstly, welcome, Christy. You're aware of all the statistics, I'm sure. It's a huge challenge to protect children. So how did you find yourself in this role?
I actually became a West Australian police officer at the age of 28 when my daughter was 2 years old. So I had this tiny little toddler when I was going through the academy, and my first posting after 6 months in the academy was into the Pilbara of Western Australia. So I went straight from Perth, like literally the first week after I had come out of the academy. The academy is obviously a very curated experience. It's you know, there to train you, but it's not real life. One of my first jobs was to a child sexual abuse case, first responder to a child sexual abuse case of a young 11-year-old girl. And so I think from that point forward, it kind of, well, I was a mum and I had a little girl, and I was obviously very nurturing and empathetic, and I wanted to help people, but that sort of started that process. And then about 9 months after I was in the police, I was a probationary constable, the detective senior sergeant asked the whole station, does anyone want to become a specialist child interviewer? And I put my hand up, and a specialist child interviewer is specifically trained for 4 to 5 weeks on how to interview children to get their evidence for court in a special way that is permissible by the Evidence Act. So it's really quite intense training. And in that training, I learned so much. So my daughter was just 3 years old by that stage, and I learned so much about what offenders do, their grooming behaviours, who they target, their, the vulnerabilities they're looking for, and then also learning how to talk to children about this from as little as 3 years old. And when I came out of that training, and again, like I'm saying, I can keep putting it back to how old my daughter was, because she was the measure stick of what I was doing. So I've come out of that training and started interviewing children in the community. I was interviewing every week kids who had been sexually abused and abused. From that moment forward, it kind of, I think, set the path to where I am now. After 4 years as a constable, I became a detective, and I put my hand up to go into the child abuse squad, and again, saw more child sexual abuse and more so historical child sexual abuse. I was investigating both current cases and historical cases, and I saw the absolute devastation that child sexual abuse does on families, on victims, survivors, how it can change a child's whole trajectory from a happy, normal childhood into going down a path that they probably didn't even, they don't even put two and two together, because obviously we know, and I'm sure some of your victim survivors that you've spoken to have said, they might not have felt safe to tell anyone and took them down a pathway. It might have been substance abuse or domestic violence or other abuse. And then, they're looking back on their lifetime 30 years later going, well, it all started here. That's what I saw there. And then towards the end of my career, I was in the police for 10 years. I was responsible for interviewing children, investigating the cases, locking up the bad guys, for want of a better explanation, and then also managing child sex offenders when they came out of prison and were released into the community. So that was the last 2 years of my career. And so, as you can imagine, that whole 10 years did leave its toll. I was suffering from PTSD and anxiety, and my daughter, who was almost 12 by the time I decided to retire, said to me, I don't want you to do this job anymore. You're not the mum I remember. So the next day I went in and retired and put my resignation in. So that was 10 years and one day after I started.
I cannot imagine how you even took that on. I mean, as an empath, I think I would find it really difficult to cut myself off from, you know, what you're being told, but also the emotions that those children are going through. One thing that caught my attention in there was you worked with, at the end of your career, the actual offenders themselves when they were being released back into the community. How often do you think that happens successfully?
Oh, not very many times. I don't think there's in a lot of cases, there's no rehabilitation, and they're not forced into programs unless it's through their parole boards when they're released and stuff like that. There's a lot of legislation and issues around what goes on if they put their hand up. So it's in Western Australia, it's not mandatory to do any kind of programs, sex offender management programs. So in order for them to go into a sex offender management program, they have to put their hand up and say that they're a sex offender. And if they do that in prison, they've got a big target on their back. So a lot of them won't even tell anyone what they're there for. The only people who know are obviously the prison officers. And then so when they come out, they sometimes get court ordered supervision orders and things like that, and then they've got to do some sort of counselling and rehabilitation program then, but there's not a lot of them. So in my whole 10 years, I only had one person actually, one person admitted to what he was doing before I even spoke to him. He had some historical child sexual abuse cases. He was a teen at the time when he abused his nephew and another child and a couple other children, and he put his hand up to all of it. So most child sex offenders won't put their hand up or admit to their abusing.
One thing I've learned in my lifetime of speaking with people and sharing stories is that everyone has a backstory, and most often some sort of trauma that leads them to where they are, either when things are bad or when they've improved and they've found a way to recover. So even sex offenders surely have a backstory. Did you find there was a commonality amongst that story as to how they became like that?
Well, in my experience and in the research, so there's three types of sex offenders. So there's a predatory or pedophilic offender. I call them pedophilic because they're easier to understand. But the predatory offender is they're born with an attraction to children. They grow up with this attraction to children. And I haven't seen any research saying where and what and how this comes about, but they just have an attraction to children. They're the classic child sex offender predator. And interestingly enough, research shows that around 97% of them will be attracted to young boys, not females. When I ask people, what do you think a sex offender looks like or a pedophile looks like? Most of the time they're thinking, you know, that creepy old man in a white van kind of thought, you know, they go to that sort of those flashes or whatever in history. That's kind of like who I would put in that category. But then the predatory or pedophilic offender generally will not be able to have relationships with adults because they don't have an attraction to adults. They cannot sustain a relationship like that. The second person to that is the opportunistic offender. So these people can have an attraction to both children and adults. So these offenders are generally likely to be in a relationship with someone and then offend against children around them. So they can have what looks like a normal relationship, normal marriage, normal family life, and then they might be offending against either their own children or children close to them, their grandchildren, anyone that they can get their hands on. And then there's the situational offender, which they don't generally have an attraction to children, but something happens in their life where they lose control. I liken it to, you know, when someone breaks into a house and they're there to break into the house and steal stuff, but then all of a sudden they rape the occupant or something like that. It's like the situation was there and they could do it, right? So that's sort of like what happens with a situational sex offender or child sex offender, is that their life, something's got breaking down in their life. They've got no control over whatever's happening. Their marriage is broken down. They've lost their job. They've regressed on like their drug rehabilitation or something like that. And then the only thing they can control is who they can abuse in that moment. So they will abuse a child that's in their care or close to them. It's not cut and dry with regards to child sex offending. And it's not that we can pick them out of the community. It's not that we can see them walking around and know who they are. You know, over 90% of all child sex offenders are unknown to the child. They're in the child's life. 47% of them will be someone related to the child. So when we look at what the child sex offences and some it's something that's cultivated in their lifestyle. There's research that shows that early exposure to domestic violence, especially with young boys and young men, can increase their risk of offending in later life. There's also more research now that shows that, and I always say this in my experience, a lot of people I interviewed or was, you know, arrested for other reasons or whatever, you know, they had a history of child sexual abuse in their childhood. But most of them don't go on to go and offend. And in actual fact, just because you've been offended against as a child doesn't mean you go on to abuse as an adult. It's less than 5%. But there is research showing that if a child, a male between the age of 10 and 15 or 10 and 17 is offended against first time, they have a higher risk of going on to offend as an adult. If there's something to do with that pubescent stage of childhood, that if they get abused in that time, then they're more likely to go on and abuse later on. But it's still less than 5%.
Given what we've just established about predators and offenders and the chance that they may be rehabilitated, how can we actually step in and prevent child abuse?
Well, first of all, we need to admit that it's a massive problem in Australia. 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 5 boys will be sexually abused by the time they reach 18. And a lot of people have the opinion that not my child, not my family, not my community, when it happens in every place, every community, everywhere. So when we come to that realization, because at the moment 28.5% of Australians, adult Australians walking around, have been sexually abused as a child. So 1 in 4, over 1 in 4 people have been sexually abused as a child. So when we come to that realization and that awareness, we can go, okay, it is a bigger problem than what we probably think. It might not have happened to us, but it could be happening to or happen to the person next to you, and it's a good likelihood. So that's the first step, awareness about the actual realization. You know, it's not that creepy man in a white van. It can happen in a family home. You know, one of the crazy things that I saw as a detective was that a family could go through 30, 40, 50 years with no sexual abuse or no apparent sexual abuse, and then all of a sudden grandfather's abusing grandchild. And it was just enough degree of separation that person went on to abuse that child. So, and I'm not saying that grandfathers, I'm just speaking in general terms here. Just because it didn't happen to you doesn't mean it can't happen to your family. So that's the first part. The second part is that we need to, just like we teach road safety, swimming safety, all of the safety that we teach our kids, we need to teach them about body safety.
So what age do you think that starts at? When should we start talking to children about body autonomy?
Yeah, so from 0. So from the minute they're born, we can talk to them about it. It's not something, you know, of course, they're not going to be replying and being able to give consent to us and all of that. But, you know, when we do things with our babies and when we do things with our little kids, we can explain what we're doing to them. Hey, you know, I'm just going to change your nappy. I'm just going to wipe your nose. And whilst we're doing that, we're explaining what we're doing to their body because it's their body. And that's what bodily autonomy is about. It's their body. We don't have the right to assume that we can do whatever we want to them. But whilst we're doing that and we're modeling good, safe adult behaviors, like telling them what we're doing to them, explaining what's happening to their bodies from birth, and also asking them consent when they get to an age that they can start giving consent or offering them an opportunity to do it for themselves, then when someone else comes into their life and doesn't give them those opportunities or doesn't follow those rules that we have set up, that modeled behavior, then they're more likely to say something and they're more likely to know that this is my right. I have the bodily right for no one to touch my privates, which includes the mouth, by the way, and for no one to do anything to me that I don't want them to do. I find it really frustrating, and I didn't really think into it very hard when I had my own daughter, but she kind of was my first guinea pig in this, right? So she was who, you know, got all of the learnings and teachings that I went through as well because she was at that age. But as my daughter grew and as I got more aware of this, you know, we don't think about this. We don't own our children. We might bring them into the world. We might give them somewhere. You know, it's our job to protect them and get them to adulthood. So we need to give them all the tools. And some of those tools are bodily autonomy, body safety, talking to them about consent, because when they get to adulthood, then they're going to have all of those skills. And these are life skills.
How much do you think that plays into some of the issues we see around domestic violence and, you know, the issue of consent full stop through adulthood?
Massively so. Like I didn't mention, but when I left the police and I couldn't stop thinking about all of the children and all of the families that, you know, were left, I felt like such a failure leaving the police. Like, that was part of that was the PTSD speaking and the anxiety and stuff like that, because, you know, I really loved what I was doing, but it was costing me my mental health and my family. So the best thing I could do is walk away. But when I left, I felt like I was a failure. And so I started writing down. All I could keep thinking is, why don't people know what I know? Why can I see it but no one else can see it? I was in a very privileged position to have that experience, to see those things that most people didn't see or don't see until it's too late. So I started writing all of that down. I ended up publishing a book 2 years ago called Operation KidSafe. And in that book, I talk about the fact that body safety is like the bottom layer of the foundation of the house. And then we can add on to it. We can talk to them about consent. And then we can talk to them about pornography and sex and sexting and nudes. And because we've got that bottom layer, this beautiful bottom layer of foundation that keeps them safe and teaches them about when they feel unsafe, what does it feel like in your body when you feel unsafe? Because unless children have the language, how are they meant to tell us? And that is the biggest thing that predators and pedophiles and child sex offenders use against a child is their naivety and their vulnerability. And their vulnerability is that they don't know what they don't know. So they will use that against a child and they will gamify their abuse. They will groom the child to enjoy the abuse. And then a child grows up believing that that is normal. Then we wonder why children go on to harm other children, or it's happened and they didn't understand it. No one stepped in. No one stopped it. And then they're doing it to some other child. And that's generally when police get involved, because obviously, you know, that child speaks up or someone else speaks up. So it's just really important. Body safety can start at as early as birth, definitely from 2 years old onwards for sure. It's the foundations of the house. We put in all of the other foundations. And by the time they get to dating age, we've talked to them about healthy relationships. What does a healthy relationship look like? What does consent look like? How do you ask for consent? But we've asked for consent 100 different times that had nothing to do with sex or being intimate with a partner. We've asked them, is it okay if I take a photo of you? Is it okay if I post that on my private Facebook page? Is it okay if I help you wipe your bottom? Oh, no, you don't want me to? Okay, here, you do it yourself. Is it okay if I tickle, you know, all of the things that we can do? Is it okay if I give you a hug? You know, giving kids a choice.
One thing that I was confronted by with my grandchildren, which I hadn't been aware of as a parent, and that's a disclaimer right now, that we in society have this saying, oh, go on, you know, give your grandfather or your grandmother or your auntie or my friend a hug before they go. And I'm not sure why we feel compelled to do this, but it's a generational thing that's entrenched. And I realise just how we're betraying their consent by even telling them to do that. And it was my grandson, who doesn't really like touch, and I ask always, can I have a hug, or would you like a hug, or can I give you a hug, or would you give me a hug? Many different ways. And sometimes, you know, he'll say, no, or he'll just retreat. You know, when he was younger, he'd just retreat behind his mother. And I'd be like, I see you, Harry, I love you, and I respect that. That was part of a process for me, but it was because he went through this horrific experience with another family member where he was instructed in no uncertain terms to hug someone that was a distant relative that he'd never seen before and he was 5 years old. How do we stop this ingrained behaviour that we see in society?
Well, we call it out. We call it out. And we say to people, like, I'll give you an example. My daughter, she learnt through this process of talking about body safety is if she didn't like it, to say, put her hand up in a stop sign, stop it, I don't like it, right? And so her grandfather used to think it was hilarious to tickle her all the time. And sometimes she was tolerant of it and sometimes she didn't like it. So she would say, stop it, I don't like it. But he would continue. So it was my job as her protective parent and her protective adult and safe adult to say, hey, she said, stop, stop. We need to set the boundaries that we expect. If our children put up a boundary, we need to model what that say, that respecting that no or respecting that stop is. Because, again, let's put it back to when they get to their first sexual experience and they don't know how to receive a no, and then they force something. Your child, your sweet, beautiful child who never intended to hurt anyone but doesn't know how to receive a no from someone, then goes and harms someone because they didn't listen to that no. They didn't know how to receive it and they continued anyway. And I saw cases of teenagers who were, you know, I was investigating sexual assault cases where teenagers just didn't know how to receive a no, didn't know how to ask for consent, and then consent wasn't obtained. So therefore, it was never the intention to hurt someone, but they just didn't know how to deal with it. So that's our job. We're the parents. Let's teach our kids proper. And that's why it's not, you know, domestic violence is everyone's responsibility. It's a community responsibility. It's a collective responsibility. But also this is all a collective responsibility. And part of my belief is that every person I talk to goes on and empower. If I can empower your listeners to go and start calling out some of this stuff and just saying, hey, the child said no, don't continue. Some things I used to say to my father-in-law was, look, hey, she said no. You know, we're trying to teach her that it's okay if she doesn't want to do something. So can you please make sure you listen to her when she says that next time? She said no, stop. And then eventually she started using the language as she got older. Instead of a stop it, I don't like it, stop it, I don't give consent. And she was about 10 by that age. And when you're a 10-year-old girl saying that to a grown adult male, it's pretty in your face. But she was empowered to say that and speak up like that. So that's how I would recommend it.
This is the change I want to see right across the board. I hope that you continue doing this great work, but I'd love to revisit this conversation because there's so much more, I think, attached to the same messaging, including, you know, our youth crime rates and a whole heap of other family dynamics. Christy, you've been amazing. You're my hero this week, so thank you so much for the work you do.
Thanks, Kim.
Let's stay in touch.
Thank you so much, Kim, and have a good rest of your day.
You too, Christy. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Child safety expert and abuse prevention educator Christy McVie, profiling sex offenders and providing valuable information to help you keep your child safe from sexual predators. We'll revisit conversations with Christy about online safety. And if you think a child is being abused, there are many steps you can take to report it to your local authorities. You'll find all of that information online. For Christy's contact details, if you'd like to book her to speak at an event, access her resources, or follow her on social media, you'll find all of that in the episode description. Next week, a confronting story of sexual abuse from a man whose life mission is to educate children on body autonomy and save them from what he went through as a six-year-old. John Kahneman explains why it takes survivors so long to speak out and what you should do if someone you love discloses abuse.